history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you're from in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some pretty incredible stories to tell if you only take the time to ask and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service to our country. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Grand Junction, Colorado, on the western slope of the Rocky Mountains. Beautiful country. We're not far from the Colorado River, from the Colorado National Monument, from so many natural scenes to gaze at. But we're going to hear a story that involves some other parts of the country and a gentleman who grew up around these parts. 94-year-old Rex Rainey is our guest, served with the 45th Infantry Division in World War II. But I want to hear, Rex, what it was like growing up around here. You grew up in Fruta, Colorado, which is, what, I guess the northwest side of Grand Junction?
Yeah, mainly west, a little north.
Really close to the Colorado River, or the Grand River as it used to be called.
Correct.
What do you remember about your childhood? What kinds of things did you do around here?
Well, I grew up on a farm, so I learned how to plow, disc, hoe, cut hay, thrash grain. We even drew sugar beets for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I also fed hogs for years because no market for our crops, so feed them to pigs and you could get a little cash.
So that's what happened during the Depression? There was no one to buy your grain?
Right.
And that's what your family grew, was wheat and sugar beets and what else?
Corn, mm-hmm. Alfalfa, pinto beans. We tried navy beans one year and the weather and navy beans didn't cooperate.
Live and learn. Did you have much help on the farm? Did you have siblings that were working hard out there too?
Three brothers and four sisters. We all found out what farm work was like.
I guess so. That's a lot of farm hands. So life on the farm with seven siblings during the Great Depression. I imagine that experience probably gave you quite a bit of perspective on life.
Well, you learn to grow most of what we ate, and we learned to make a lot of things. You learn to do your own entertainment.
Mm-hmm. What were the big entertainment things around here? What did you do for fun?
Oh, if you got a chance, you went fishing, picked up a few neighbors that could have a little time off, and got a softball or hardball game to go on. You took your old .22 and went along the washes, seeing what kind of animals you could find that would cook up.
What kind of game would that be? Cottontails?
Cottontails and sometimes a gray squirrel. Or once in a while, a pheasant got mistaken for some other type of an animal or a quail.
Sounds like quite the adventure. Do you remember, I know it's a long time ago, I mean, we're talking 80 years ago, but do you remember as a young boy, as a teenager, having some big ideas or ambitions of what you wanted to do in life?
Yes. While I was in high school, I hoped to go to college and become an electrical engineer, but it didn't work out.
Well, and I think I read that you joined the National Guard before you finished high school. Is that right?
Yes.
And this is before America is in the war.
Yes.
What was the thinking there? Was that to help the family out?
Oh, chance to get a little bit more money, spending money, because they paid you for each drill. It was a chance to get to travel a little bit, because they went for, when I joined, 2 weeks each summer. You went to Camp West over by Denver or someplace. That was the first year, and then the second year we went to Louisiana for a month. Little experience.
Mm-hmm. Did it ever occur to you that a war might be coming along and that it might be more than a little experience and a couple weeks at camp?
That's a yes and no question. You were well aware of it, but you figured if there's war, you was going to be in it one way or the other anyway. I enjoyed the National Guard.
December 7th of 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you got the news?
I was in Old Mexico. There was five of us having a good weekend. And when we came back across the bridge, the guard told us we'd better get in uniform and get back to camp. That Pearl Harbor had been bombed. Mm. It had been a pleasant night before in old Mexico.
What was that like as a young man to hear that news and find out, uh-oh, now this is real?
Well, we was all supposed to be home by Christmas that year because we'd served our year.
Mm-hmm.
None of us ever tasting tequila before. We thought it'd be nice to have a gallon of tequila to take home for our buddies. So we brought a gallon of tequila across the border with us. And then when we got to camp, we were quarantined. No one could leave camp. So being some type of a group of young guys, we decided to play a little drink or smell poker. But the bourbon ran out before long. So then we tried to get rid of a gallon of tequila. Wasn't a smart move.
Were there any repercussions?
No.
Other than the physical?
Other than the head the next day. So there was repercussions, but I think most military understood.
So I imagine your training kicked into high gear now that America's at war. What kinds of things were you training to do personally?
I had gone into the National Guard as a lineman. That's when we were inducted. Then in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where we first reported, I became a switchboard operator. When we moved to Abilene, I was made a corporal in charge of the switchboard and the linemen. Then I was made a sergeant in charge of the communications.
Mm-hmm.
That was it at that time.
Were you one of those who was eager to go overseas and get a piece of this, or you were in no hurry whatsoever?
Oh, for some reason, I wasn't in a hurry. We knew it was coming, and I think I wasn't in a hurry because my oldest brother, the day after Pearl Harbor, he went down and joined the Marines and was back in Los Angeles with 56 bullet holes from his waist down while we were stationed at Fort Devens, Massachusetts.
Mm.
And for some reason, I wasn't in a hurry.
I think we're getting a picture of what the reason was. And there were four of you boys.
Yes.
Did all four of you end up in the war?
No. My older brother Vern and I did. And my brother, just younger than I, was born deaf in one ear. Then my baby brother was far too young.
Mm-hmm.
He was still, I think, in grade school. But he served later both in Korea and occupation of Germany.
Wow. So quite a legacy of service in your family. And your brother Vern is the one who's wounded in the Marine Corps.
Yes.
So before you ever ship out, one of your brothers is already back from the war, and clearly his life's going to be a lot different with the injuries he suffered.
Right.
I could see how that would impact you. Before we move on with your story, how did that affect him for the rest of his life?
Well, I don't know how many operations he had. He was still in the hospital when I got back from the service, and I think I'd been home several months before he finally got out of the hospital.
Wow.
Could walk with a cane.
So here's a guy in his early 20s, and he's going to be walking with a cane the rest of his life.
Well, he was determined.
Mm-hmm.
I think he used a cane for 2 or 3 years and insisted life had to be different. Got on with the Forest Service as part of their maintenance crew. And he spent quite a few years building roads, trails, bridges.
So he goes over early, gets wounded with the Marines, and you left for overseas a lot earlier than most of the World War II veterans alive today did. In fact, and a lot of people mistakenly think that's the first time that America made a landing in Europe. That's not the case. You were part of one earlier than that. But the first place you went with the 45th Infantry Division was North Africa?
Yes.
What was that journey like across the ocean? Had you ever been on a ship before?
That's the first ship I'd ever been on.
Uh-huh.
It wouldn't make sense to most people, but it took us 21 days of zigzagging. We saw how the Navy operates when they think there's a submarine in the area. I'd hate to tell you how many barrels we saw shoot off of a sub-destroyer, I guess they call them.
The depth charges to try to get the subs.
Yes.
Because as early as you went over, this is 1943, that U-boat threat in the Atlantic was still significant. There were a lot of Allied ships that were being hit.
That's right. Not all of them made it.
So I imagine That might have been a little nerve-wracking for a young man from Fruta, Colorado.
Well, you got to where you just kind of laid on Navy ship because what could you do? They were doing all they could to protect you, but the blood did circulate a little.
I imagine. And I know, again, this is a long time ago, but if you can think back to that young man heading overseas and what was on your mind, was this something? I mean, you've already seen your brother get wounded, and you know that he's got a long battle.
Well, I've heard about him.
Right. You haven't seen him yet, but you got the news in the mail. Did you think you were going to come back?
Not really.
You'd come to grips with that. The likelihood was?
Well, I didn't think about that. After we'd landed at Iran and got the sea legs gone, and then we invaded Sicily, about our fifth day on Sicily, we'd had casualties before that, but that's the first time we had any KIAs. We got five that day, and it brought things home pretty fast.
Mm.
But we still had no doubts, and Sicily went pretty good. Then after that, we went to a place called Salerno, Italy. That's when you decided you better make the best of every chance you get because you're not going to the States.
Mm. It was that grim.
When you call on White Phosphorus shells to keep from being a KIA or a prisoner, you get a little different perspective on life.
I can imagine. And I know this is not easy to talk about. And before we started, you told me that you've spent a lot of years trying to forget some of the things you experienced. And I don't want to take you anywhere that you don't want to go. And I so appreciate your willingness to help us understand what people like you went through so we have what we have today. What was your job in these landings and these invasions? What were the things that you had to carry out?
This is hard to explain because when I set foot in Sicily, my commanding officer said, Rex, you're Battalion Sergeant Major again. I came in on the third wave in Sicily, caught up, and he said, the first thing I want you to do is get a Tommy gun and take my Jeep. And he said, we got about 300 prisoners I want you to take back to the first MP you see. That was my introduction to Sicily.
I guess so. Welcome to the war. So how did that go? How did that unfold?
Real good. I think the reason Sicily went so well, a lot of it, the Germans depended on the Italians to defend, and most of the prisoners were Italians. They were glad to wave the flag and come out. First MP I saw was a second lieutenant in an MP Jeep, so I flagged him down, and he told me I would have to take him back to the beachhead. Having been acquainted with him in Fort Devens, Massachusetts, I had my opinion of him, and I racked back to Tommy, and I said, sign for 300 prisoners, or you don't go further. He told me, he said, I'll have you, and I told him, fine. You tried it at Fort Devens, and you ended up in the MPs, because he was assigned to a line company up there.
Of all the people you had to run into, huh?
Yeah.
So you left the prisoners with him?
He wrote me a receipt for 300 prisoners.
Moving on from there, you mentioned the landing at Salerno, and I was asking you what kind of duties or role you had at that point. Was it different there than it had been at Sicily?
Completely different. Normally, a sergeant major isn't on the line. But before we got off of Salerno, everyone but the cooks took frontline duty.
Mm-hmm.
You all became infantrymen. Cooks were busy doing things you didn't want to do.
Because the casualties were very high.
Lots of men lost there. Our battalion lost one platoon of Baker Company and a reinforced platoon of Charlie Company, where that some of us called on White Phosphorus chemical mortars to stop the German advance on us so we could get out of that area.
At what point do you make that decision? Because the way you're describing it, it sounds like that's kind of a last resort.
Well, you've got some people captured. You got tanks and anti-tracks and half-tracks. They've got machine guns. You know you can't remain in that area. And we had a bank to climb, so you, human chain, you climbed on each other and one got up and then you helped the next. That's when you called on the White Phosphorus, when you got on the bank and called, so the Germans stopped.
Because if you didn't, you would have been overrun and you would have been captured or killed.
Correct.
How did you handle that? Because, I think of your age. I mean, you're what, 22 years old at the time?
Somewhere in that neighborhood.
Were you scared?
Tell you the truth, the soldier that tells you he was never scared, I wouldn't believe. Mm-hmm. But it was a different type of fear. It was I may be going down, but some of you are going with me. Mm. Well, that was my mentality. You don't go down without a fight.
And what were you armed with?
At that time, an M1.
One rifle?
Right.
And you already described what some of the opposition was. And are there enemy artillery shells coming in on your position, too?
Those German 88s are just as deadly as an artillery shell. But I think the Germans had crossed over the street from Sicily and were waiting in there because they hadn't had full chance to regroup.
At this point, are you starting to come to grips with the death around you? Guys that you trained with or knew or were standing right next to that are getting killed?
You're well aware of it. That's where I decided to get as many as you can, and I guess I wasn't successful because I set my store at 70 Germans before they get me. I'm here, so I must not have got 70.
Well, and I'm sure there were plenty of times where they almost got you, and in one case, you were wounded. You're a recipient of the Purple Heart. We're going to hear about that. But were there some moments where you came really close that really got your attention?
Oh, I was on Salerno in defensive position. The tanks and half-tracks were coming down on us, and the report, I don't know for sure, but the report was the tanks were doing a half-circle over a foxhole, and German soldiers were bayoneting them. And someone, thank goodness, had some power and called for air support straight from our front lines. The P-38 is not a popular aircraft, I don't think, but it sure earned the respect of a lot of infantrymen because they came in and they went down our line and came back, and something told me to set up in my foxhole in the back of it, and in my foxhole a 50 caliber slug lit. But they knocked out two tanks and the rest of them and the half tracks all fled. So
That's why the Germans called that plane the fork-tailed devil, the P-38. So it saved your guys' lives there, those P-38s that came in, but nearly took your life. This is a friendly fire shell from a P-38 that landed how close to you?
Well, I was in the back of a foxhole, and it landed where my head had been. Because some said set up, and so I set up in the back part of the foxhole.
Like, and we're talking about a split-second decision.
Or less, yeah.
If you hadn't moved, your head's disintegrated.
Right.
But you move, it hits right behind you. And you're not wounded at all?
No.
How do you explain that?
The good Lord looks after you.
I guess so. Is your heart pounding a little bit after something like that?
For a while.
And I think the rest of ours will keep pounding throughout our first commercial break. Rex Rainey, 94 years old, of Grand Junction, Colorado, is our guest today. You'll find a short video of him on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll hear more about his close calls with the 45th Infantry Division in Italy when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proud to
proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old Rex Rainey of Grand Junction, Colorado. We heard about his first couple invasions with the 45th Infantry Division, Sicily and Salerno. Before we're done, we're going to hear about the Second Battle of the Bulge, the often overlooked fight in Alsace, which overlapped with the more famous fighting in the Ardennes Forest. But right now, let's talk about one word that really is infamous for veterans of the Thunderbirds of the 45th Infantry Division, a spot on the Italian coast where the Allies got bogged down and just didn't advance. Mr. Rainey, what do you remember about Anzio?
Well, I remember two or three things. What they call the Mussolini Canal, and we call the swamp. We spent so many days along that thing. Most of the time you didn't dare show up in daylight, or you had an 88 round whizzing by.
Because they had everything zeroed in from their position?
Yes. And the only time during the war that I spent 29 days in one foxhole, and then we moved from there, had our first shower and clean clothes and shaved and went back upon the line. And I'm not sure how many days we were there. We got a call that we made a march over toward the railroad tracks and the caves to fill in for where a unit had been wiped out. We hadn't fully got deployed there yet when a shell hit and shot one guy's heel off, and killed another one that we couldn't find shrapnel or anything on him. He's bleeding from the ears, mouth, nose. And we got those back and finished getting in position. And that night, the Germans gave us both Anzio Annie, I don't know.
Big railroad gun.
They were whistling by there, but we was also getting bombed and 88 and artillery fire. We didn't get much German artillery. They used mainly 88s, but we were getting all of it. And the person I was sharing the foxhole with said, "Rex, I've been hit." And I looked at him and he had a lung out through his back. And I asked him if he could hold on while I got the medics, and he said, "I don't know how long I got." So I took him over my shoulder and carried him back to the medics. They went to taking care of him, and I went to leave, and Sergeant Whitlock, that I'd known since Camp Barkley days, said, "Rex, where are you going?" And I said, "Back up." And he said, "You don't know that you don't have a seat on your pants and you got blood?" I didn't know I'd been hit.
Wow.
And he insisted on doctor and filling me up with sulfa powder and bandage and wanted to put me on the ship, but there'd been a couple of Red Cross ships bombed going back to North Africa. I figured I was as safe on the line as any place. So he fixed me up and said, "If I don't see you within 3 days, I'll look you up." And he kept his word. 3 days later, he came up and took the bandages off and said, "Surprisingly, you're going to live."
For how long in those circumstances?
Well, for another one.
Yeah. A few questions come to mind. For one, what were the extent of your injuries once you realized? I mean, I think that's incredible for people to hear that you're so focused, the adrenaline's pumping so much, and you're trying to help this friend that clearly is in mortal danger here, that you don't even know that your backside's been torn off by shrapnel?
I had no idea.
And how bad was it?
I never did. He came up and changed the bandages for me and told me in 2 or 3 days, if you're all right, take that off and throw it away. Otherwise, I'll be looking forward to seeing you. All I remember from that is, 15 years later, little metal flakes kept coming out of that left leg. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what it was really like. But
But it turns out where it got you was probably pretty fortunate. Didn't break any bones?
Very fortunate.
Just took some flesh?
Apparently.
Yeah.
And left something that for 15 years, little metal things worked to the surface.
Mm-hmm. When's the last time you pulled one of those out?
I think I was principal at Hotchkiss, Colorado, junior, senior high school when I got the last one up.
I imagine a lot of thoughts came to mind when you were picking those out of there. But since you didn't come home, I mean, you're wounded, you received the Purple Heart, but you're still out there with the 45th, and the fighting's not done yet. We were talking about Anzio. When I've talked to guys who were there, when I've read about it, I try to imagine what it must have felt like to be stuck in the same spot. You mentioned it. You said the same foxhole. A lot of guys were in foxholes for a lot of days, but not the same foxhole in the same spot without moving for a whole month.
Right.
How hard was that mentally and emotionally to be stuck in that kind of situation?
It was tough. You prayed for dark because you could stretch your legs a little bit in a filthy canal. As I say, we called the swamp. Mm-hmm. And it was a swamp by then because that's where all your body waste ended up.
Sure. It's about as miserable a situation as you can find yourself in.
You don't want no seconds. No seconds. But when we went to go out of Anzio, we were told the day before there will be a 3-hour barrage of artillery and naval fire, and every minute we'll move forward 100 yards. And you're to jump off. I don't want to tell you either 0-300 or 0-600 now. I don't recall. But at a certain time, we were to jump off and plan on trying to cover 100 yards a minute.
Mm-hmm.
We got to the highway and started our march to Rome.
And that had to be a pretty significant day for you with what you'd been through.
It was a welcome day.
Yeah. I don't want to bounce around too much, but you mentioned Anzio Annie, and I didn't mean to cut you off there. Maybe some of our listeners have heard about this before, but this is almost a mind-bogglingly giant gun that they'd roll out of a tunnel on railroad tracks, right?
That's what they told us.
Yeah. How did you experience it?
You just listened to it several times a night. Whoop, 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 whoop. And you thought, that one's going by. People on the beachhead got that one. We read in Stars and Stripes that they basically wiped out a hospital unit or two. Mm. And lots of nurses and doctors didn't make it. But I never witnessed what they did to the ground. I was never back there.
You mentioned Stars and Stripes, and it brought to mind another thought, a footnote in 45th Infantry Division history. A guy who had an impact on millions of Americans serving in World War II, but was in your division, Bill Malden. Did you ever see his work, his cartoons during the war?
Oh, we look forward to the weekly Stars and Stripes because he had Joe and Willie in there, too close to reality.
Mm.
He had an imagination.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we look forward to what Joe and Willie were doing then. And our entertainment on Anzio was Axis Sally.
Ah.
If we could get near a radio, you crawled along at night to where that you could listen to a radio because Axis Sally was the biggest morale booster. The Germans may thought they were tearing us down, but she was good to listen to.
What kinds of things would you hear from her?
Oh, American songs and popular songs back in the States.
Uh-huh.
And just pick up a leaflet and we'll assure you safe package home. She was a super sales lady from her point of view.
Yeah.
But we all enjoyed her singing, and she had a very pleasant voice. Even when she was telling you things you didn't want, you thought, gee, it's good to hear a woman's voice. So.
Yeah, the little things. So the propaganda didn't bother you. You got the music and her voice.
It was the best morale builder we had. It was looked forward to.
I'm glad you brought that up and shared that. And with regard to Joe and Willie, the Bill Malden cartoons, did that help you guys maybe have an outlet or a little bit of something a little more lighthearted than the grim and dire nature of what you were doing?
Very few people didn't get a chuckle every week. Yeah, we thoroughly enjoyed.
And he was one of you guys, the Thunderbirds.
Yes.
I know we could go so many different directions here. Over 500 days, 511 days the 45th was in combat.
That's what they tell us.
Yeah. I'm sure they blended together at times, but you were there for all of it.
Would you mind if I skip back?
Yeah.
to the winter line, have an afro for a minute before we went to Rome.
For sure. You're in charge.
And it was one of those things way out there. If we had had a decent army commander, there would never have been an Anzio. We would have destroyed the abbey above an afro.
Monte Cassino, you're talking about, right?
Yes.
That abbey?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Because the Germans were operating out of there.
They were operating out of the top of it.
Yeah.
We, with field glasses, could see them looking at us with field glasses. One night, we had a lot of storm while we were there. We'd had 2 or 3 days of rain. We'd lost contact with Charlie Company. Mm. And I'd sent the runner out 3 times, and he said, I can't find them. I thought, well, I've had to find companies before. I'll find them. The next thing I knew, the storm stopped, and I was on top of the mountain within a few hundred yards of the abbey, Mount Cassino, and I could see 2 Germans and a dog sitting there, and I thought, this isn't quite where you belong. So I started to come down, and there was a sign, Octuminum. My German's terrible, but meant a German minefield was there.
Yeah.
And thank goodness the moon was shining bright then. I tried to backtrack my steps, and then I really sweat because our pioneer platoon had been mining in front of our troops every night.
Mm.
So I just tried to walk in tracks as near as I could, hoping.
Because you've got German mines and American mines that you have to dodge.
And then I see BAR and machine guns pointing. I thought, well, thank goodness I'm back now if they don't see me.
Mm.
And I picked the one that went over, and thank goodness the gunner was asleep at his post. And I stuck my finger behind his trigger and shook him. I wanted to know where his CP was, and thank goodness he knew. And I was at the upper end of the company. He told me his commanding officer in first charge was down by a certain part on the trail. But the thing about that one was I lost my fear of not seeing the States. For some reason that night, I said, you're going to go to the States someday.
Hmm. What do you think that was?
I think that's whoever's up there.
Yeah.
Call him what you want.
Yeah. Well, what did you call him?
Oh, I've called him quite a few things over the years.
That foxhole and Anzio, you probably had a few conversations.
But I didn't mean to digress onto that. Because that's one night I've cherished and I've fought.
Hmm. Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that because it sounds really significant in your 94 years here, an unforgettable night. Was it that in seeing how close you were to the Germans, knowing you were in danger in this minefield, that either side's mines could get you, that your own guys could shoot you coming back, and that you survived all that, that somebody must be guarding you?
Someone had to be.
Hmm. And at the time, did you carry a faith with you that you believed that kind of thing, or was that experience something that solidified or even generated that kind of faith in you?
Well, I had not been a good church attender since 8th grade. I believed there was a supreme being, and I'm not condemning anyone for this.
Sure.
I was never one that what I call wore his religion on his sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
Really wasn't a church attender, but I think I was a believer always.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think what I hear you saying is that that night, God became a lot more real to you, and you felt his presence.
When I was hiking back down the trail to boot the company commander and first sergeant out and see what the devil was going on, it was with relief.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how hard I kicked, but I never got such enjoyment that I remember.
And was that the company that you'd been searching for?
Yes.
So you did find the missing company?
Yes.
And I want to take you back to something you said, and I don't, maybe you were referring to Mark Clark on this, but you said...
Is that what he was?
What'd you call him?
Mark Time.
Because you marked so much time on the beach at Anzio?
Throughout all of Italy.
Yeah.
If we'd had a patent in charge of us, there'd never been a Salerno, I don't think. There'd never been a winter line. There definitely wouldn't have been an Anzio.
You felt that the fact that you were bogged down there was something that he could have handled better. Could have moved you.
I'm probably wrong, but yes, I feel that.
And for folks who aren't familiar with the story of the Abbey at Monte Cassino, what was your understanding of why they took so long to look at that position militarily?
I've never understood it, because they wouldn't let us bomb it. And yet when we were breaking out of Rome, they tell me they flattened it and then American dollars rebuilt it. It's a question mark.
But if they had taken that position out sooner, could have saved a lot of lives, and you guys would have moved.
There wouldn't have been a winter line. We'd have probably been in Rome by Christmas that year. Biased opinion.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm sure you're not alone in that opinion.
It's time for another break, but Monte Cassino is a topic you can find quite a bit of information on online. The Axis and Allied powers had agreed not to bomb the Abbey, and there are some who insist to this day that the Nazis never operated inside of it. You heard Rex Rainey's perspective. And when we come back, we're going to hear what an hour at a newly liberated concentration camp did for his perspective in 1945. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is a recipient of the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart. 94-year-old Rex Rainey of Grand Junction, Colorado, spent 511 days in combat with the 45th Infantry Division in World War II. In early June of 1944, just days before that massive invasion at Normandy, you Thunderbirds in the 45th were there as the Allies took control of Rome. What do you remember about that?
Well, we went by Rome for about 6 miles, and then we stopped. We were starting to get replacements, and since our company commander let me have his Jeep whenever I wanted it, unless he had a use for it, why, his driver and first sergeant and I went into Rome a couple of times, rightfully or wrongfully, Vatican City Church, St. Petersburg.
St. Peter's, yeah.
We were told by a guard we couldn't get in there, and I'm not proud of GIs, but you rack back a bolt on a 45, and even the Vatican guard understands he can come in. And so the three of us fisted it, and he showed us all around, shaking all the time. And when we went to looking at that ceiling, which is beautiful, he was praying, I think, for him, don't shoot. We saw what we wanted, so we left.
Mm-hmm.
And we did drive by some of the old ruins, but that was, we'd been to Rome. There was some Italians voluntarily joined our outfit and fought alongside us. I think things were pretty good. Mm-hmm. We bought quite a bit of hard bread because it was different than a C or a K ration.
Sure.
We went to a few barber shops because after a while you do get to where you can't hardly stand things.
I imagine. Were you starting to get the sense that momentum was on your side and that this wasn't going to take too much longer?
No.
Not after everything you've been through, huh?
No. Berlin was a long ways away.
Yeah.
From above Rome, then we went back to Naples and boarded ships and went to southern France for the invasion of southern France.
So here's another invasion that you guys are making.
Yes.
And what was that one like?
That was the best one we had ever made.
The cleanest?
And we lost no men on it. We had lost one boat in Sicily. We didn't lose any at Salerno, but we went in and to an old farm kid, southern France was beautiful country.
I bet.
We didn't hit too much opposition for the most part, and so to speak, it was a paradise.
Well, and in a matter of months, you would see the opposite of paradise. And I'm curious, this whole time that you're fighting over there in Europe, had you heard anything about concentration camps, about Hitler's persecution of the Jews, or how he was treating other political prisoners?
We had heard things about them, but it was hearsay. There was a lot of stuff went on before we got to Munich. And I can stop any time because somehow you've got some things coming back that have been dormant for a long time. They may not be in order, but there was a place called Aschaffenburg that our orders were to bypass it on the right. We were getting pretty well by it, our unit was, when suddenly we got under fire and we were pinned down for 5 days. Later to find out that there was a handful of SS troops there and his women and children under orders to fire or be killed, that held us up. And that town wasn't marred because it was reported no activity.
Huh.
It was leveled before we left there.
Wow.
I've always felt sorry for those people. And then there was a place on down, Rambervillers, that we were going along, and I'd gotten orders to move the CP up X number of blocks. We were 2 blocks behind where the line was. 3 of us were up there, a Jeep driver, myself, and a person from the intelligence section. And we never got a wire. We didn't have a radio. So we sat there, and we sat there. Then we got up the second morning, and here's a German 88 sitting 3 blocks away. So I told them to make sure and don't pull covers off the windows. Don't go outside today. And that night I told them I'll take first watch because, with all respect to the one from intelligence, the only way I could explain him was he was a nervous Nelly. If he'd seen that tank, he'd have started firing. And the Jeep driver, he's a close friend. But he had said, let's go to the Jeep and make a run. And I hiked back the 8 or 10 blocks and ran into a guard. And thank goodness he recognized me when I spoke. He said, we're jumping off tomorrow morning and going to retake the town. That we pulled back because one flank was all open. And they were coming in behind us. And that had been filled in.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a place called Reapersweiler that we lost our reinforced 2nd Battalion. Someone wasn't as sharp as they were supposed to have been.
But you brought those up because those are some close calls for you. Any one of those things going the other way, if you had gone with the intelligence officer's idea or your Jeep driver, you might not be here.
That's right. Yeah. And we were someplace in Germany when that CO's Jeep came wheeling in, hollering for me. And so I asked him what he wanted, and he said, well, Captain thought you might want to go to the car. One platoon of Charlie Company had just entered it. They'd gone in across the railroad tracks on the back way. Well, I guess it was Easy Company from 2nd Battalion took it officially from the front.
And so this is near Munich, the Dachau concentration camp.
Yes.
They ask you if you want to go.
And the company commander thought that I might want to go, so I hollered at the first sergeant and asked if he wanted to see it, and he said yes, so we piled in the Jeep, and a few miles down the road, bunch of railroad cars. And we first looked at them, and there were bodies in stock cars and in the gondolas and along the tracks and between them and hanging out of them. And it's something you never expected to see. We didn't like what we saw. They had the crematorium, the big gas furnace going, and there was bodies piled up like cordwood that they had been, I guess, thrown in. We were about an hour after the camp was entered before we got in there. I don't think we had an hour before we was ready to go back. And then from then on, it was a simple march into Munich, and
The
war was over.
Did you see any of the survivors of
the
camp?
Oh, yes. Yes, they would come and try to claw on you, get you to take them out. But they were walking skin and bones. I didn't see near all of them, but yes, I saw probably, I don't know, 50 or 100.
You saw enough to get a feel for what had happened there and what kind of
too much
cruelty people were capable of. I don't want to make you dwell on it, but anytime I meet someone like you who was there, and I think I mentioned to you my grandfather was at Buchenwald when it was liberated, it's not just a straw dog. There actually are people in this world that don't think that happened, that think it was all made up. And you were there. You saw it.
I'd hate to tell you how many people were dead or dying in stock cars and gondolas. Some of them were half in and half out of a train, couldn't move anymore. You can't imagine. I can't imagine what it was like, really. And I spent about an hour there.
Yeah. And maybe not in the moment, but eventually did that experience and your coming face to face with that give you maybe even a new understanding or appreciation for how important the work that you'd been doing over there was?
It made you do a little thinking. It made you willing to travel to Denver when that Colonel Sparks arranged for a marker in remembrance of the Holocaust to be placed. But yes, I thought it was worth a trip from Delta to Denver to pay respect for something being put up for them.
There's something else along those lines I want to touch on with you. I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. Was VE Day a big deal for you?
We read about it in Stars and Stripes. That's all I know about it until after I got back to the States. When you see pictures, and you don't know how true they are, but the Normandy invasion, a lot of men gave their lives up. VE Day was important, yes. I just happened to think of the Second Battle of the Bulge, and we were in Alsace at the time. We didn't suffer many actual KIAs, but we had a lot of injured from tree bursts. Mm-hmm. We had never encountered tree bursts before, and snow's on the ground, you don't dig foxholes very well. Our artillery was out of ammunition, and we could see 7 tanks coming, and suddenly everything stopped. Thank God they ran out of gasoline. They were out of gasoline out down here. For once they were down low, we were up high. We were out of artillery shells. They were out of gasoline.
If they had had 5 more minutes of gas?
It would have taken them at least that much or a little longer. If they had had 20 minutes more gas, there would have been something else.
You guys would have been wiped out.
A good chance.
You keep giving me examples of somebody looking out for you.
No question about it.
And I come back to when I asked you about going overseas, and you said, didn't really think you'd be coming back. When you did come back, what was that like for you to see America again after 500 days at war?
It was a while. If you would believe this, on my way from Munich, they'd told me that I'd be taken to Le Havre and flown back to the States for a 45-day leave.
Uh-huh.
Then some brass preempted, and so enlisted men got in 48 cars and headed to Marseille. And I came down with malaria on the way to Marseille. So I spent 11 days in the hospital in Marseille before I got on board ship. I don't remember the voyage. I don't remember coming into Patrick Henry. I don't remember a train ride. I remember coming to in Denver at the Federal Center. was called up by name and serial number. And I went up, and the guy took a quick look. And he said, "Sergeant, you sure you want to leave?" He said, "I can see 127 points, and we're discharging people with 85. And I said, "What's the catch?" And he said, "You might have to spend up to 24 hours more here." No problem. I don't know what it was really like, but I remember I got my discharge at a little after 11 that night, and I went down to Denver, went into a store and bought a suit, left all my Army outfit in there and wore a suit and shirt and tie out, and then I got a hotel room.
How long was it till you made it back to the farm and saw your folks?
I caught a train out the next morning.
What was that reunion like?
It was good. They had no idea I was in the States even. I don't know if someone had called them, and they met me in town.
A moment you never thought was going to happen.
For a long time, I didn't think it would, but it all worked out.
Amen. And it worked out that you met a young lady in Delta?
Right.
Named Betty. You guys are heading toward your 67th anniversary?
Right. Never did get to be an electrical engineer. When I got out, I wanted no part of that. I was going to go into business. So I took a business training. But my accounting professor talked me into going out to teach instead of pursuing business. He's the fault of all this.
So because you went to teach in Delta, you met Betty. What was it that caught your eye?
I don't know. There was a good-looking secretary there, but I hadn't thought about it, and the Letterman's Club, what they call the D Club, invited me as a guest to their spring banquet, and I was supposed to bring someone. I thought about a faculty member or two, but I couldn't see that. And then I thought, well, there's someone in the front office. That doesn't look bad. She agreed to go with me. It was her downfall.
The rest is history. You must be doing something right if you're getting close to your 67th anniversary. People ever asked you for that advice? What's the secret to a marriage that lasts that long?
Don't disagree too seriously with your wife, but don't agree to everything the first time.
Have you ever thought about the fact that you never would have met Betty? That your two kids, five grandkids, and four great-grandkids wouldn't be here if you didn't survive all those close calls?
Well, I've thought of it a number of times. When I got my discharge, I had told myself I was never going to marry because the doctor insisted I couldn't get a discharge, that I had to check into Fitzsimmons Hospital, and I disagreed with him.
Because he thought you were still injured badly enough, you needed attention?
He thought something, and he called two other doctors, and three of them met for a while. And they told me, "You've got two choices. Plan on spending about a month in the hospital, or you'll never see your 50th birthday."
Was this because of the malaria or the injury?
I don't know.
Okay.
They never told me what it was, but I just said, "I want my discharge. I live for the day that I was a civilian again, and I can't be a civilian in Fitzsimmons." And I took the discharge and came to Delta knowing I was never going to get married.
God's plans are always better than our plans, aren't they?
Someone's outthinks us most of the time.
That's great. So 70 years ago, your decision to go against medical advice actually turned out to be one of the best decisions you ever made.
I've thought I've survived this long because of it, and I'm not knocking them.
Sure, sure. No, but you knew. You knew what you needed to do. I do want to say, before I forget, thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for going back there with us.
It took a while to get things to fall in mind.
I guess the last question I have for you, when you think back over all this, I mean, you're going to be 95 in August. You're in combat for 500 days. You're wounded. You saw a concentration camp in person. All these experiences, a career in education as a teacher, as a principal, as a school district administrator. When you think back, what are you most proud of? What are you most thankful for?
The Delta Letterman's Club.
Because if they didn't invite you to that function, you and Betty would have never gotten together. I'm just looking at your eyes. Looks like you can't imagine a life without her.
It's been pleasant.
And that's just one of the ways to describe this unforgettable hour we've spent with Rex Rainey. Hard to fathom everything he went through. I don't know about you, but it left me as sure as ever of those four words with which we close each episode of Hometown Heroes. We'll do that right now as I thank you for listening, trusting you'll remember that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.